June 25th, Thursday, was a unique jewel of a day. The next 24 hours were, because I saw a new part of the United States, Mackinac Island. I breakfasted in the hotel, and then from the airport went to Pellston, Michigan, where I was met by Nancy Williams, Mrs. G. Menon Williams, and Mrs. Philip Hart. Thank goodness, not in her little one-engine plane. There was quite a crowd along the fence, and I went up and down shaking hands. And then there was a car waiting for me to take me to Mackinac City, through a rather lonely countryside, mostly wooded with conifers, what I took to be fir or balsam or spruce, and there were ferns knee-high through the woods. In an occasional clearing, there would be a cherry orchard. I understand that's one of the big products of this part of the state, and also crab apples. At the dock in Mackinac City, there was another small crowd, and a great, magnificent expanse of Coal Lake. I shook hands with a lot of youngsters and then climbed into the speedboat to cross the straits to Mackinac Island, as well as I could understand the geography. On my left was Lake Michigan, and on my right, Lake Huron, and we were going across a fairly narrow point where they met, where there was about a 20-minute ride by speedboat to Mackinac Island, a spot that congealed in time about 1895, though its history goes back much farther indeed. It became the great fur trading center of the northern Great Lakes when Fort Mackinac was built in 1780, thereby making it secure from the Indians. Traders would come from all over the surrounding Great Lake area, bringing their beaver pelts, because all gentlemen wore beaver hats in those days. There was some mink and otter and other furs, but beaver was the fur. One of the great charms of the island is that there's not an automobile on it, except the fire truck and the ambulance. Everybody walks or goes on bicycles, or rides in the most delightful carriages with handsome wicker-type bodies. I wonder what museums they raid to get them, pulled by horses that have a red tousle or plume above their heads. I was met by Stuart Woodfull, my host, the manager of the Grand Hotel, who had put his own personal home at our disposal. The town's vacationers had turned out in mass to greet me at the dockside, also the mayor, and then Mr. Woodfull escorted me to this elegant carriage. I never felt so much like Cinderella. The driver had on a well-tailored red coat and a high silk hat. It was a vis-a-vis. Four of us could sit in it, two on each side, facing each other. And Jerry Kiffett sat beside the driver up front. Oh, the varied life of a Secret Service agent! Mr. Woodfull's home was a comfortable, spreading white house, built, I would think, about 1900, with bright yellow awnings right by the side of the lake. The yard was full of lilac trees, enormous, trunks as big as your thigh. The first ones had been brought over by the French settlers, the fur traders who had come in the 1780s, and had reached their height with William B. Astor, B. for Backhouse, the chief fur trader of them all, in about 1820. The island is covered with balsam and cedar and maple, which must make it a blaze of glory in September. And it's dominated by the Grand Hotel, the very arch type of summer hotel, an enormous frame structure, white, and the longest front porch in the world, 885 feet, they tell me. It faces the lake. Red carpeting comes down the front steps to right where the carriages stop. Bright red geraniums in pots line the steps and the gallery, and flags flutter all along in front of the long porch. Since 1887, it's been a fashionable resort for people from Chicago, Detroit, the Midwest, a sort of family vacation. Mr. Woodfull was a most interesting host. He introduced us to the couple who took care of him, and then Liz and I had lunch alone, and I spent the afternoon lying in bed, watching the ships go past my window on the Straits of Mackinac. It's absolutely wonderful not to hear any automobiles. Instead, I heard the rhythmic beat of the waves on the shore, and smelled the scent of lilac through the open windows. How nice, too, not to have air conditioning. About 5:30, I dressed up my best, and downstairs was greeted by the president of the Michigan Bankers Association and his wife, who escorted me and Liz in a buggy to the Grand Hotel. There we attended the reception, stood in line, met every banker in Michigan, practically. I doubt if there were many votes for Johnson there, but there certainly weren't any less when I left, I believe. Maybe a few more. I kept on meeting displaced Texans. Next, we drove up to Nancy Williams' residence by buggy for dinner. Her house is typical Victorian, as are practically all of the fine old homes on Mackinac. Turrets, gables, a widow's walk, gingerbread, a flag out front, which they were just about to take down as I arrived because it was sunset. Inside, huge fireplaces, and it was going, and we needed it. Paneling of an elaborate rococo type that's no longer done, and a lampshade as big as a parasol of bright, varicolored glass, practically a museum piece of Victorian household decor. Besides Nancy and her daughter, Wendy, who goes to NCS and struggles with it just as hard as Lucy does, there was Mrs. Neil Stabler, the wife of the congressman-at-large who's running for governor, Adelaide Hart, vice chairman of the Democratic State Central Committee, Miss Sadmont Brown, wife of the state treasurer, and then one of the most interesting guests, Mrs. Hugh Rudolph, who is herself a state park commissioner, and she's the daughter of former Senator Prentice Brown. I'll get back to her in a minute. And Mrs. Walter Murray, wife of the chairman of Mackinac Island Park Commission, and Miss Carl Nordberg, who is wife of the state park superintendent. And Anne Lunn, whom I'd known in Washington, who also has a home here on the island. So many people do. We went to sit in a little circular, glassed-in room where you had a superb view of the water, and they told us a lot about Mackinac. Quaint is the word that you can't get away from. But to me, its most interesting quality is that it seems to have stopped, congealed, in an epoch of history. Probably the one in which it reached its peak, about 1900, the essence of Victorianism. Nancy's own house is delightful, and she has used color liberally in the way that I like to use it, apparently having picked up old furniture and painted it, giving each room a bright, individual, gay color scheme. We went all over the house and up to the widow's walk, where the view of Lake Huron, Lake Michigan, the ships, the lighthouse, the cedar, balsam, tamarack-covered hills, the marvelous outcroppings of rocks, the fort, and most particularly the water, was superb. As always, when you have more than one witness, the stories varied a great deal, but it appears that about 1,000 or more people live on the island in the summer, which lasts from Memorial Day to October the 1st, although it's pretty cold all of June. But then, October the 1st, the hotel closes, all the summer people leave, and just a few who like to be out of the world, 250 or 300 people, remain on the island. The straits soon become clogged with large pieces of ice, and sometimes it freezes over entirely. And it's possible, but dangerous, to go out in an automobile or on foot. There's a little plane that comes in twice a week to bring mail. Everybody is supposed to have stocked up very well on groceries, I suppose, during September. It's just a four-seater. There's a doctor and a nurse who live on the island. Tourism is our main trade. Charming basket carriages that you see were made about 75 years ago, they told me. Nancy says that though the state of Michigan has no governor's mansion, that quite some time ago they bought a summer mansion for the governor there on Mackinac Island, and that she had spent many happy years in it. And when Soapy decided not to run again, he said, "You're going to miss the island, aren't you?" And she said, "Yes, more than anything." He said, "Well, you'd better just look around and find another house." This was one of the houses that had been built by a member of the Cudahy family. We had a delicious dinner with wine. And Mrs. Rudolph, the daughter of Senator Prentice Brown, told us how she goes trapping. She decided when she came to live there, she might as well get all there was out of living there. So she'd do what the early settlers did. She went trapping for mink. You set the trap right by the water. The next day when you come back, you hope that the mink has rolled into the water and drowned, because he's a vicious little animal if he hadn't. And you approach him through the shallow water of the little streams, because he has an almost unknown capability of using his musk glands just like a skunk. And he can spray you so that you'll wish you had stayed home. Also, you'd better have a club handy, because if he's still alive, he's a vicious little creature. She had caught enough mink to make herself a coat, and enough beaver for a coat for one of her friends. Most unusual and delightful person. All around, there were things that Nancy had brought back from her visits to Africa. I enjoyed her very much. She's a very vital woman. Our politics have largely been at cross purposes, but that just could be because we didn't know each other. Liz and I went home rather early, after a unique and wonderful day, to go to sleep by that most soporific sound, the rhythmic beat of water on the shore. I wondered in a completely relaxed sort of way, whether Lennon was making any headway, Papandreou of Greece, whom he'd had to luncheon. Too bad he couldn't be enjoying just what I was now. I'd been glad to see that on the guest list were my old friends that I traveled to Greece with, His Eminence Archbishop Yavakas, Judge John Pappas, and Mr. John Plumides. Also to know that the Greek I've known longest of all, George Vernus, was there, besides such old friends as Saul Tashoff of Broadcasting Magazine, Frank Russell of NBC, and Raymond Buck of Fort Worth, who must just have happened to be in town.